Gaza to be completely wiped out? Are they waiting for 10 more thousand, 20 more thousand people dying before they call for ceasefire? Enough is enough.
I do not come here alone. I carry my people in my bones.
So we're here at
voices from protest in Boston last night calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. At least 23 people were arrested. This comes as 13 Democratic senators call for short-term cessation of hostilities in Gaza. And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Hani Massoud, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Remember the days of wandering the pumpkin patches in search of just the right one to bring home? Not too big, not too small, but with a little bit of personality? Well, the days of mucking through the chilled autumn air are over. Now you can grab a KeBu pumpkin crew neck or long sleeve that fits just right and keeps your elbows protected from the elements. Pick up an organic, homegrown, community-sourced piece of merch in gray, green, navy, or maroon and rock this autumn in style. Just check out the sidebar on our website at kebu.fm to harvest your KeBu pumpkin apparel today.
You're listening to KBOO Radio. And now for the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders rally around striking PPS teachers.
A former Memphis police officer pleads guilty in connection with Tyree Nichols' death.
And in international news, the militant group Hezbollah speaks out about the war in Gaza for the first time.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 3rd, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. Today was day three of the historic Portland teacher strike. It has closed over 80 schools and impacted nearly 43,000 students. Teachers, students, and their supporters have been meeting each morning at schools across the city and then gathering for rallies in the afternoon. KBOO reporter Isabel Charlet, who is also a member of the teachers' union, has more from the picket line.
Yesterday, thousands of teachers, parents, students, and their allies converged at the PPS district building to show their support for the strike. This is PPS parent Koya Crespin.
Our teachers are fighting for the students' right to clean and safe buildings, smaller class sizes, and more mental health supports. These are not unreasonable demands. Why am I sending my most precious, my most dear, off to schools where the ceilings are falling in and the heat doesn't work? Why am I trusting PPS management when they are essentially spitting in my face, stonewalling our students at the bargaining table?
We have to have our basic physical needs met in order to engage in the complex thought learning requires. This is not possible in a classroom that is 95 to 100 degrees.
That's right.
After writing emails to management and filing OSHA complaints and filing a formal complaint with our principal that included over 70 staff signatures in support of immediate action, after all of that, district management did nothing. We deserve better. Our students deserve better.
I've been an educator now for 22 years, and I have seen the needs of our students go up and up and up. I have seen the demands of our administration on us go up and up and up. And what I have seen is our resources go down and down and down.
Right.
That ends now.
Yeah.
They're ignoring, they've been ignoring us. This bargaining team has been ignored at the bargaining table for 10 months. Well, they can't ignore you while you're out there on a picket line.
Because you know the kids don't do what we say, they do what we do. When we fight back, we make them think it's normal to fight back. Yes. If we're compliant, we make them think it's normal to be compliant. Do we want to do that?
No.
Do we want to teach them, no matter the inconvenience, we should always do what's right?
Yes. You know, I've always felt like classes are too big. It stresses me out. And that's why we're gathered here today. Whether it's too big classrooms or too little pay, we need to give our schools the help that they deserve.
You just heard from teachers Joy Root, Steve Lancaster, and Darshan Preet Gill, as well as students Ari and Sam. But it's not just Portland who's showing up to support this strike. Union leaders from across the country have come this week to show their solidarity and share some of their experiences organizing in their own cities. This is the president of the Minneapolis Teachers Union, Marcia Howard.
And you know what I notice when I look at this manufactured crisis that Portland Public Schools claims that you're in? It sounds real, real familiar. But I'm gonna tell you what else is real familiar. A bunch of dedicated educational professionals finally, finally getting up and walking out and holding the line for their students, for these families, and for themselves. Every single student that comes into Portland needs to know that they are cherished. Every single student that comes into Portland needs to know they got a dedicated and fairly compensated educator. And the way that you get that is doing what you're doing now, which is letting everybody see what you are prepared to do to get what your community, this city, this nation needs. Hold the line!
The Portland Association of Teachers is meeting again today with PPS management to try and come to a resolution, and will likely meet over the weekend as well. PPS families will know by Sunday night if there will be school on Monday. For KBOO News, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Portland unionized teachers are on strike for a third day. There are still resources available for students and families while schools are closed. Grab-and-go meals are being offered at sites across the city. Several schools around the city plan to offer free meals until the strike ends. In addition, nonprofit organizations across Portland are opening up to students, offering activities to keep students occupied during the day. Their programs are not intended to be a direct replacement for school. One is Portland Metro Arts, a nonprofit organization that usually offers summer camps. This week, they've started offering full-day care for students at $60 a day, providing instruction in the performing arts. Students are allowed to bring in their schoolwork. That program can support about 30 to 35 students, but the demand is much higher. The Blazers Boys and Girls Club is working with the Urban League of Portland to provide a free day-long space midweek. Boys and Girls Club of Portland CEO Terry Johnson said, quote, "As that negotiation process is playing out, our focus is to make sure that families who are impacted by the strike have somewhere for their kids to go and also have access to food," end quote. About 40 students showed up yesterday during school hours, and about 120 showed up for the after-school program. Johnson added, quote, "We're going to be there 100% of the way in making sure that kids have access to a safe, positive, and transformative programming throughout the duration of the strike. This is just who we are, and we're built for it," end quote.
3 years after Oregon voters decriminalized small amounts of hard drugs, some cities across the state no longer support that stance. The League of Oregon Cities, plus several police groups and prosecutors, are calling on state lawmakers to recriminalize drug possession in the February legislative session. The organization is a lobbying group that represents cities around the state. They are demanding a host of changes to state law next year, including a rollback of 2020's ballot measure 110, the state's drug decriminalization measure. Oregon is suffering significantly during the current nationwide fentanyl epidemic. The state has long lacked adequate drug treatment options, and those issues are compounded by a mental health crisis and severe housing shortage. Since Measure 110 passed, polls suggested voters are feeling much less lenient towards drug users. Recent research finds that decriminalization did not contribute to more overdose deaths in the state. The measure was aimed at connecting drug users to treatment and recovery services, including housing assistance, instead of serving time in jail for possession. The lobbying group calls for criminalizing drug possession and making possession of a controlled substance a Class A misdemeanor. Repeat offenders could face a low-level felony charge under the proposal. Some supporters of Measure 110 point out that the law has diverted thousands of people away from the criminal justice system. They suggest restoring low-level criminal drug charges could add cases to an already overburdened system. Lawmakers and Governor Tina Kotek have already suggested they will prioritize a legal fix.
A former Memphis police officer pleads guilty in the fatal beating of Tyree Nichols, becoming the first of five officers charged in the case to admit guilt. Desmond Mills Jr. entered his plea yesterday during a hearing at the Memphis Federal Courthouse. It wasn't immediately clear if any of the other involved officers would follow his lead. He did so in exchange for prosecutors recommending a 15-year sentence, and he remains free on bail ahead of his May 22nd sentencing hearing. Nichols' mother, Ravon Wells, said, quote, "This one today was very difficult for me because this was really the first time I actually heard somebody tell and say what they actually did to my son. So this was very difficult. But I'm hoping it was his conscience that allowed him to make this plea agreement and not because of his lawyers telling him it was the right thing to do," end quote. Nichols was stopped for reckless driving by police in January 2023. In graphic video footage, five police officers punched, kicked, and beat Nichols with a baton until he was in a coma. He died 3 days later, prompting national outcry and close scrutiny of policing practices in Memphis. The five former officers who were charged in the Nichols case are also black. Mills and four other former Memphis Police Department officers were charged with using excessive force, failing to intervene, deliberate indifference, conspiring to lie, and obstruction of justice. Shelby County District Attorney Steve Milroy said Mills' cooperation, quote, "probably would incentivize the other officers to also consider plea deals too." After Nichols' death, all five officers were fired from the department and the crime suppression team they were a part of was disbanded. Mills will cooperate in the U.S. Department of Justice's investigation into the Memphis Police Department.
A George Santos ouster fails. Secretary of State Blinken makes a request of Israel. And other senators continue to call out Tommy Tuberville for blocking military promotions. Edwin J. Vieira tells us about those stories and more with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is a victory for the process. Due process won today, not George Santos.
A House vote to expel Congressman George Santos fell far short of the two-thirds needed. Fellow New York Republicans pushed for his removal after Santos was indicted for stealing identities and credit card details of campaign donors. That, on top of previous charges of financial crimes. Santos continues to maintain his innocence and says he'll serve his Long Island district until the people don't want him. But that's already the case. The community group Concerned Citizens of NY03 backed his expulsion. Group member Kim Kaiserman says some GOP representatives voted to keep him to protect their narrow majority, putting it before the people in his district.
It's, I think, cynical and corrosive of democracy to say that preserving one vote is worth more than the representation that more than 700,000 people have the right to enjoy in their government.
The House Ethics Committee expects to release the results of an investigation into Santos in 2 weeks. The White House is calling on Israel to pause its Gaza attacks to allow for the release of hostages. Israel has opposed that, arguing it would allow Hamas to recover. But critics here and abroad charge Israel is committing genocide and say there needs to be a full ceasefire, not just a pause. The Democratic Senate leader, Dick Durbin of Illinois, is calling for a long-term peace deal.
Whatever the rationale from the beginning, it has now reached an intolerable level. We need to have a resolution in the Middle East that gives some promise for the future.
Under new Speaker Mike Johnson, House Republicans have passed a standalone $14 billion Israel aid package, but Senate leaders say they won't take it up, and President Joe Biden has vowed to veto it if it reaches his desk. House Republicans are still considering the President Biden impeachment inquiry in spite of legal experts testifying there is no basis for it. Speaker Johnson insists they're just pursuing the truth.
We have to follow due process and we have to follow the law. That means following our obligation under the Constitution and doing appropriate investigations in the right way, at the right pace, so that the evidence comes in and we follow the evidence where it leads. We follow the truth where it leads.
Senators from both parties and on both sides of the abortion debate are voicing increasing frustration with Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville's hold on hundreds of military promotions. Tuberville says it's in response to a Pentagon personnel policy covering abortion and says he won't relent in spite of 9 months of pressure.
I cannot simply sit idly by while the Biden administration injects politics in our military, again, injects politics in our military from the White House, and spends taxpayers' dollars on abortion.
The Senate confirmed three top military officers Thursday, including the first female member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and debate included unusually angry remarks by Tuberville's fellow Republicans. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6 p.m., it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 7, we have Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather has the potential for heavy rains. The low will be 57. Tomorrow, we'll have steady rain in the morning with showers in the evening and clouds overnight. The high will be 63. Today in history, in 1534, the English Parliament passed the first Act of Supremacy, which made King Henry VIII head of the Anglican Church, cutting out the Pope and the Catholic Church. And our quote of the day is from him, King Henry VIII, who said, quote, "Hops are a wicked and pernicious weed."
Since the beginning of the war in Gaza, Israel and Hezbollah have traded fire at the Lebanon border, raising fears of a new front opening there. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised address threatening further escalation as the four-week-long Israel-Hamas war continues. But he stopped short of saying the militia would fully enter the conflict. Hezbollah is an ally of Hamas, and Nasrallah says they are not deterred by U.S. warnings to stay out of the war. He said American warships in the Mediterranean Sea, quote, "will not scare us," end quote. Nasrallah says that Hezbollah's cross-border attacks have pulled away Israeli forces that would otherwise be focused on Hamas in Gaza. His address to supporters came a day after the most significant escalation in fighting between Hezbollah and Israeli forces on the Israel-Lebanon border. It came on the same day that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to urge for a humanitarian pause to the fighting. Netanyahu said Israel is, quote, "going full steam ahead unless hostages are released." U.S. officials haven't gone so far as to call for a ceasefire, but 120 countries in the UN did vote for a humanitarian pause last week. To date, over 9,000 Palestinians and 1,400 Israelis have been killed in the war. A second front to the war would certainly spell more heavy casualties, as Hezbollah has far more firepower than Hamas.
Multiple efforts are underway to keep Donald Trump off state primary ballots. Mike Moen tells us more from Minnesota.
The Minnesota Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in a high-profile case that involves efforts to keep former President Donald Trump off the state's primary ballot. It mirrors similar efforts elsewhere in the country over his actions on January 6th. One of the key questions tied to the case is whether Trump is responsible for citing the insurrection and if those actions come in conflict with a clause under the 14th Amendment. David Sturrock, a political scientist at Southwest Minnesota State University, says another question is whether states have the authority to make the determination and whether or not they want to set a major precedent.
The courts generally err on the side of allowing voters to have choices. They're reluctant to tell voters or election officials, no, you can't include the candidate's name on the ballot.
He says that factor weighs heavily while acknowledging these are uncharted waters and that it's reasonable to question Trump's actions on January 6th. Court observers say the justices appeared skeptical of the arguments from petitioners. Their attorneys contend that Trump engaged in a rebellion against the U.S. Constitution and that the 14th Amendment is worded to keep insurrectionists from taking office again. A similar case is unfolding in Colorado. Sturrock says another thing to consider is the fallout that could happen if the court sided with the plaintiffs who want Trump removed.
It makes it all the easier the next time for either party to come after a member of the other party on trumped up charges. And the easier you make it to use a tool, the more likely the more hot-headed members are to use it.
He says that's evident right now in Congress as some members try to censure their colleagues over matters not deemed worthy of such discipline. Sturrock says another challenge facing petitioners in Minnesota is a time crunch ahead of the primaries, especially if these cases wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
The Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador issues an apology for a failure to protect Indigenous students. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador has apologized to Inuit people in Northern Labrador for the harm suffered in residential schools. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Andrew Fury said in his official apology that the provincial government failed to protect Indigenous children in those schools.
I extend this apology to the students, their families, and to the people of Manitoba. We are sorry.
Premier Andrew Fury has been touring Inuit communities along Labrador's northern coast over the past week. He is making six stops where he will offer apologies to residential school survivors and their families. Fury told them that the provincial government turned a blind eye and neglected its responsibility and duty as a government.
So today, with a heavy heart, I respectfully and humbly offer an apology to the students of Unit 2 of it who attended residential schools in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Fury acknowledged that many children were separated from their families and their communities and sent to the schools where their connections to their culture, language, and families were degraded. Many of the survivors of the five schools in the region shared their stories of sexual and physical abuse or neglect. When former Prime Minister Stephen Harper apologized in 2008, he excluded people in Newfoundland and Labrador because the five schools in the region were not funded by the Canadian government. But that changed in 2016 after a class action lawsuit. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A new children's book in the Tlingit language was celebrated at a recent gathering in Juneau, the first of its kind in decades. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, it's the first of a nine-part series.
Do you all agree this book is beautiful, huh?
Tlingit and Haida's President Richard Peterson held up the book to show off the illustrations by two Tlingit artists, Nick and Kelsey Foote. The book is called Kahanta, which means orphan in Tlingit, a story about a girl taken in by a powerful family and through her struggles learns life lessons about the tribal values of respect. Peterson wishes he had had a book like this to read when he was a boy.
We didn't have these opportunities. And it may not make sense because certainly we had more elders, we had more first language speakers, but we know because of things like boarding schools and historic trauma, there was a lot of shame and people telling us that we couldn't proudly be who we are.
But students from the Tlingit Culture, Literacy, and Language program were full of pride as they performed at the celebration. Joel Maserve, a Tlingit language instructor, says the new book will help learning become more meaningful.
These kids are so fortunate to see themselves in their teachers, in their curriculum, in our books, and in their community.
If you're looking for the English version, it doesn't exist.
Hune Lance Twitchell says the language needs to stand on its own. He worked with a team of elders to produce the book that included George Davis, Marge Dutson, and Ethel Mackinnon.
I thought of Marge, and I thought of George, and I thought of Ethel, and how much I wish I could show this to them.
But Hune produced a video of the book so everyone can both see and hear the story. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A recent report shows mixed results for women's and children's mental health with an increase in quote-unquote frequent mental distress. Here's Farah Siddiqui with more on the story.
A new report finds Michigan women have mental health concerns at rates higher than the national average. The United Health Foundation says the number of women between ages 18 and 44 in Michigan who report frequent mental distress jumped to more than 25% in 2021, from 18% just 5 years earlier. Marnie Levitt, who heads the Women's Center of Southeast Michigan, says social media and ease of access to information have led to an overall uptick in anxiety and depression, and a world in turmoil isn't helping.
People feel helpless and more aware of the ongoing war in Ukraine and the new war in the Middle East, in which we have a great awareness that the primary victims of those conflicts are women and children.
Levitt adds concerns about climate change and their children's education are other top contributors to mental distress for Michigan women. The report also ranks Michigan 44th among states for a high number of women with multiple chronic health conditions and 45th for illicit drug use. Levitt says women coming out of the pandemic have faced an unusual set of circumstances that can't help but affect their mental health.
Educated, with high student loans, unable to get jobs. Now the job market has opened up. Despite the upticks in what people are making for salaries in the Ann Arbor area, people are still almost unable to pay their rent.
Dr. Lisa Saul, who specializes in maternal and child health for United Healthcare, says mortality rates for women have increased about 40% between 2019 and 2021, and maternal mortality rates increased 29% in that time period. She says it's important to acknowledge the racial disparities in these figures and address them to keep people healthy before, during, and after pregnancy.
For both maternal mortality as well as for severe maternal morbidity, we're seeing increases in the American Indian and Alaska Native populations. That seems to be a new trend.
There are also some positive findings in the United Health Foundation report. Michigan ranks in the top 10 among states for women having health insurance, getting cervical cancer screenings, and exercising. For Michigan News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Refusing to ban books can get you fired. At least that's true if you work for a library in Arkansas. Danielle Smith tells us more.
In Arkansas and across the nation, book bans are becoming more common. The American Library Association says there were almost 700 attempts to censor library materials nationwide from January to August, and over 1,900 challenges of specific book titles. In Saline County, Patty Hector says she was removed from her position as library director for not banning books. She says a county judge and quorum court wrote a resolution advising her to pick out harmful books and move them so children could not access them. Hector says her response led to her being fired.
There's no place in the library that people can't get to. So I said no. And then that was what got me in trouble. I said no to them. And you don't say no to a bunch of men. And the books they picked up are LGBTQ and race. Two-thirds of them are.
As Hector described it, a resolution accusing her of fraud was written by the Saline County Republican Committee. She adds, after the committee reported her for violating the Freedom of Information Act 90 times, she had to spend many months answering questions about her job and library expenses. Hector says the committee also put up a billboard on Interstate 30 that said stop X-rated library books, SalineLibrary.com. She points out that some Arkansas lawmakers worked to pass a bill that would criminalize criminalize librarians, but that law was blocked by a federal judge this year.
Act 372 was going to make it a felony for a librarian to give anybody a book that's obscene, which they couldn't define. And that has been determined by a judge to be unconstitutional.
Hector notes several books with topics on sex education and homosexuality were under scrutiny, and a book entitled The Talk, about conversations that Black parents have with their children, was another title the committee objected to. I'm Danielle Smith, Arkansas News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 3rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips, jokes, confidences at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Zoe Carina. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Farah Siddiqui, and Danielle Smith. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. The violence Israel, with U.S. support, is currently raining on Palestinians is having horrible effects on human beings, first and foremost, of course, but also on journalistic integrity and humanity. As the president suggests, we need not have confidence in Palestinian accounts of the human toll, and the bombing of a hospital sees